The last days. When are the last days? Aren't we living in them now? Look how bad things are. Surely we must be living in the last days, and Christ will surely return soon. Well, whether or not we're living in the last days or not depends upon what you understand by the expression the last days. Different people understand it in different ways. So really what we have to try to do is not go by what certain theologians say or preachers say or even what I say. We have to try and get an understanding of the expression the last days from what the Bible says. So I'd like you to turn to Genesis chapter 49, the passage that we read. And this is the first expression, the first time this expression, the last days, occurs in the Bible. In Genesis chapter 49 verse 1, then Jacob called for his sons and said, gather around so that I can tell you what will happen to you in days to come. The last days, as the Hebrew says, as the King James Version says. Now why is it that the New International Version has not stuck to the translation the last days? Well, the reason for that is that in Christian theology the expression the last days has come to mean and come to refer to exclusively the days leading up to Christ's return. It's what's called eschatology, the days leading up to Christ's return. Now, that's fine. That's the way the expression is used today. That is not how the expression was used in biblical times, unfortunately. Biblical times, the expression the last days did not mean the days leading up to the Messiah's return. Or the Messiah's coming. Didn't mean that. Now if we give it that meaning, and then we go to the passages of the Bible which talk about the last days, then we take all those and say, all these things are going to happen in the days leading up to Christ's return. And in doing that, we are wrong. We've got bad, wrong, incorrect theology. Now, I don't intend to go through Genesis 49 and deal with every prophecy relating to every single tribe. It's very interesting, but you basically have a history of the Old Testament. I will deal with the first two. Let's first of all look at Genesis 49 verses 3 and 4. This deals with Reuben and his descendants, the tribe of Reuben. Reuben was the firstborn. In Genesis 49 verse 3 it says, Reuben, you are my firstborn, my might, the first sign of my strength, excelling in honor, excelling in power. Turbulent as the waters, you will no longer excel. For you went up into your father's bed, onto my couch, and defiled it. Well, that's what's to happen to Reuben, the tribe of Reuben, in the last days. Basically, what the problem had been was that in those days, long ago, before the law of Moses came in, the people of this time were allowed more than one wife. They were even allowed concubines. This may appear uncivilized, unchristian, irreligious to us. But remember that a lot of women in those days who were not second wives or who were not concubines would have just been destitute. They would have just been destitute. Work was hard. Labor was hard. Where would they have got shelter? Where would they have got comfort? Where would they have got food? In days like that, it might well have been far better to have been a second wife and a concubine than it would have been to have just been, so to speak, left to fend for yourself. Many men had been killed in battle. There was a surplus of the female population. So, under the code of Hammurabi, which was the code which ruled the lands at that time before the law of Moses, these sort of things were allowed. But Reuben did something which was not allowed. He went and had intercourse with his father's concubine. Absolutely atrocious. So much so, so bad was that. So, well, shameful was that, that basically none of his brothers listened to him. He lost the respect of all the other 11 brothers. He was to have been the firstborn. Normally what would have happened was that the head of the family would have come to him. He would have become the priest in the family, because this was again before the law of Moses, before the priesthood was given to the tribe of Levi. Then the father was the priest for the family. He was the one that did the sacrifices, he was the one that did the ceremonies. And that would normally go down onto the firstborn. Reuben, firstborn, they didn't respect him because of what he had done and what he has done. And this sin, if you like, followed on. The consequences of this sin, if you like, followed on. So much so that if you look through the Old Testament, no judge came out of the tribe. No prophet, no prince, no person of renown, no one of any consequence came out of the tribe of Reuben throughout the whole of the Old Testament. You get some terrible characters like Dathan and Abiram, who rebelled against Moses in the wilderness and who wanted to take the people back to Egypt, but nobody of any good came out of the tribe at all. Initially, the tribe was pretty strong. When it entered the promised land under Joshua, the tribe of Reuben was a very strong tribe. But the prophecy of Genesis 49 verses 3 to 4, spoken about 1750 BC, actually came true in 650 BC. If you go to 1 Chronicles chapter 5 on page 287, 1 Chronicles chapter 5, we'll read what it says there. In 1 Chronicles chapter 5 and verse 26, we'll read there, he says the following: "So the God of Israel stirred up the spirit of Pul, king of Assyria, that is Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, who took the Reubenites, the Gadites, and the half-tribe of Manasseh into exile. He took them to Halah, Haba, Hara, and the river of Gozan, where they are to this day." So, there you are. You will no longer excel. They didn't excel. And under the Assyrians, that was the end of Reuben as a tribe. And so the last days, if you like, the last days, the days to come with respect to this prophecy, was basically when the Assyrians invaded the northern kingdom of Israel and took them off into exile. Not the days leading up to Christ's return. Not even the days leading up to Christ's first coming, but basically in days to come, sometime in the future. This is basically what Jacob was telling his children. "I'm going to tell you blessings, and they're going to happen sometime in the future." It's as vague an expression as that. This is what's going to happen sometime in the future. Now let's go back to Genesis chapter 49 and look at the ones relating to Simeon and Levi. In Genesis 49 verses 5 through 7, "Simeon and Levi are brothers. Their swords are weapons of violence. Let me not enter their council, let me not join their assembly, for they have killed men in their anger and hamstrung oxen as they pleased. Cursed be their anger so fierce and their fury so cruel. I will scatter them in Jacob and disperse them in Israel." There you are. "I will scatter them amongst Israel and Jacob." Now, this curse, if you like, because it's not a blessing, this curse was a result of their treatment of the men of Shechem in Genesis 34. They had a sister called Dinah, and Dinah was basically raped. And they wanted to go and kill these men of this area who had raped their sister. But their father said, look, "I know my sons have done wrong. I'll give you whatever you like. Let her marry them. Let Dinah marry them." You know, the father was an honorable man. They said, "Well, look," this was Simeon and Reuben, "look, I tell you, Simeon and Levi, look, we can't let our daughters, we can't let our sister marry somebody who is not circumcised. You have to be circumcised, all of you." Now, these are all men, and circumcision is not the nicest of things to do, and even on a baby, and when you're a man, it's pretty horrible. They said, "Okay, fine, we'll be circumcised." So they circumcised all the men, and they were pretty sore, and they were pretty much inconvenienced. And what happened? Simeon and Levi went and killed them all. They just went and killed all the men. I mean, they were worse than them. These were people that knew God. and yet they were worse than these pagans. They were worse than the pagans. And so, because of that, Jacob was horrified at what his sons had done. And he says, I'll make a prophecy about what's going to happen in the last days, in days to come. You're going to be scattered. You're going to be scattered amongst the people. Now, when did this occur? When did this occur? Well, basically occurred when the nation of Israel, some 40 years later, no, not 40 years later, 400 or more years later, entered the promised land under Joshua. When they entered the promised land under Joshua, it was decided how the land should be allocated. How the land should be allocated. And basically, the land was allocated as following. The tribe of Levi had no land. Instead, they had cities. And their cities were dotted throughout the land of Israel. Why were their cities dotted throughout the land of Israel? Well, the Levites became the priests. Under the law of Moses, as I was saying earlier, this position of the head of the family being priest was taken away and it was given to the tribe of Levi. They were to be the priests to the people of Israel. And therefore they needed to be scattered throughout the land of Israel to be their priests, so that each family had access to a priest. And amazingly, this judgment, if you like, this curse, if you like, becomes a blessing. It becomes a blessing. And that sometimes is amazing, how God in his grace and his love works. And so the last days of this prophecy were again when the people entered into the promised land. Now Simeon, however, did, the tribe of Simeon did some terrible things. Let's go on to Numbers chapter 25. Numbers chapter 25, on a book past Genesis, you get Exodus, then Leviticus, then Numbers chapter 25. Numbers chapter 25, you have a very bad situation. Basically, people from the tribe of Simeon, well, verse 25, chapter 25, verse 1, while Israel was staying in Shittim, the men began to indulge in sexual immorality with Moabite women, who invited them to the sacrifices to their gods. The people ate and bowed down before these gods. So Israel joined in worship in the Baal of Peor. And we were looking at the terrible things of Baal in our Bible study in our video this morning. And the Lord's anger burnt against them. And verse 14 says, the name of the Israelite who was killed with a Midianite woman was Zimri, son of Saul, the leader of the Simeonite family. The leader of the Simeonites was the person that was responsible for taking Israel into worshipping Baal, into the child sacrifices, into the temple prostitutes, and all things like this. And so, what happened? Well, if you go to Joshua chapter 19 now, Joshua chapter 19, past Numbers, you get Deuteronomy, and then the book of Joshua. Joshua chapter 19, we read what was to happen to this tribe of Simeon. They didn't have an inheritance. They were scattered. Chapter 19 verse 1 says, the second lot came out for the tribe of Simeon, clan by clan. Their inheritance lay within the territory of Judah. Lay within Judah. And verse 9 says, the inheritance of the Simeonites was taken from the share of Judah. So they were scattered. And so again, the last days, if you like, the last days of this prophecy were not in the days leading up to Christ's return, not even in the days leading up to his first coming. They were in the days when Israel entered the promised land. Now I could take you through every reference in this chapter 49 of Genesis, and I would have to give you a history lesson like that, and to show you that there's probably hardly any reference in this chapter to the days leading up to Christ's return. They're all over the place. Basically, it's an expression which means sometime in the future. That's what the expression means. It doesn't mean the 7 years or the 14 years or the 21 years or whatever period of time you think leads up to Christ's return. Now when you go through the Old Testament, there's about 20 references to this expression, the last days. I won't deal with everyone. Let's just have a look at a couple more. Let's go to Deuteronomy chapter 4. Deuteronomy 4 on page 129. Deuteronomy 4, page 129. We'll read verses 27 through 30. This is what it says about the people of Israel. The Lord will scatter you among the peoples, and only a few of you will survive among the nations to which the Lord will drive you. There you will worship man-made gods of wood and stone which cannot see or hear or eat or smell. But if from there you seek the Lord your God, you will find him if you look for him with all your heart and with all your soul. When you're in distress and all these things have happened to you, then in later days, the last days, that's the expression, then in the last days you will return to the Lord your God and obey him. For the Lord your God is a merciful God. He will not abandon or destroy you or forget the covenant with your forefathers. So basically Israel were told, look, here's a covenant, the first covenant, the old covenant. This is what you have to do. The Ten Commandments summarize it, if you like. You have to do this. If you don't obey it, then I'm afraid you will be scattered amongst the nations. And you'll go off to the nation. Many of you will die and perish there. Some of you will end up in idolatry. But the faithful remnant will cry unto me, and I will gather you back. When did this happen? It doesn't happen in days leading up to Christ's return. It happened again, partly under the Assyrians, who came and conquered the northern part, and partly under the Babylonians that came and conquered the southern part. The Assyrians were what? 800 or 900 BC? Babylonians were what? 500 or 600 BC? I don't know the dates, I didn't look them up. But the details don't matter. The fact is, it's not referring to days leading up to Christ's return. Now let's turn to Isaiah chapter 2 on page 485. One look at one more in the Old Testament. Isaiah chapter 2, page 485. What do we read here? In Isaiah chapter 2 and verse 1, this is what Isaiah, son of Amos, saw concerning Judah and Jerusalem. Listen to this. In the last days, the mountain of the Lord's temple will be established as chief among the nations. It will be raised above the hills, and all nations will stream into it. Many peoples will come and say, come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob. He will teach us his ways, so that we may walk in his paths. The law will go out from Zion, the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. He will judge between the nations and will settle disputes for many peoples. They will beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation will not take up sword against nation, nor will they train for war anymore. Wonderful, isn't it? This is happening in the last days. But hang on a moment. Most people that deal with eschatology tell us that in the last days, the days leading up to Christ's return, is the days of the Antichrist, when the temple in Jerusalem will be defiled, when the mark of the beast will run rampant in Israel, when he will set up his image in that temple. But hang on a moment. It says in the last days, year, God's going to establish the temple amongst the mountains. I hope I've shown you enough to show you this morning that the expression the last days, you just cannot take it and say, it refers to days leading up to Christ's return. It doesn't mean that. It means sometime in the future. And that's all it means. Sometime in the future. Now, you have to establish, maybe from the context, maybe from the wider context, maybe from your general theology, which can be suspect, but maybe you have to do it to try to establish when this will happen. Now, according to my general theology, and I may be wrong in my general theology, this time when Israel will be set up as the premier nation of the world, when God's temple will be built in these mountains, when nations will go up to Israel to sought judgments, when people will beat their beat their swords into plowshares, and there'll be no war, that's the millennium, after Christ returns. After Christ returns, he returns to the Mount of Olives, which is the next mountain along from Jerusalem. He destroys Israel's enemies. He sets up his kingdom. They become a nation of priests. The last days, then, is referring to after Christ returns, not before it in this passage. So I hope you can see that if you are a fan of prophecy, if you do like prophecy, if you do like to dwell on the fact that we might be in the last days, you have got a problem. You have got a problem. Because the last days do not refer to days leading up to Christ's return. So let's go and look at some of the New Testament occurrences. 2 Timothy chapter 3 is one of the most famous. 2 Timothy 3, page 843. 2 Timothy 3, page 843. Now, this is what it says. In verse 1, this is what's one of the most famous eschatological passages. One of the passages that people often dwell on when they talk about the days leading up to Christ's return. But I want you to ask in your mind, does this refer to the days leading up to Christ's return? When does it refer to, if it doesn't refer to then? 2 Timothy 3, but mark this, verse 1 says, there will be terrible times in the last days. People will be lovers of themselves, lovers of money, boastful, proud, abusive, disobedient to their parents, ungrateful, unholy, without love, unforgiving, slanderous, without self-control, brutal, not lovers of good, treacherous, rash, conceited, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God, having a form of godliness but denying its power, have nothing to do with them. They are the kind who earn their way into homes and gain control over weak-willed women who are loaded down with sins and who are swayed by all kinds of evil desires. Always learning but never able to acknowledge the truth. Just as Jannes and Jambres opposed Moses, they were the magicians in Pharaoh's court in the Old Testament, so also these men opposed the truth, men of depraved minds who, as far as faith is concerned, are rejected. But they will not get very far because, as in the case of those men, their folly will be clear to everyone. What days does that describe? Does it describe the days in which we're living? Does it describe some times in the past? Will it describe sometimes in the future? Let's go back over a couple of pages to 1 Timothy 4. Let's go back a couple of pages to 1 Timothy 4 before I comment on that. This is what it says. 1 Timothy 4 verse 1. The Spirit clearly says that in later times some will abandon the faith and follow deceiving spirits and things taught by demons. Such teachings come through hypocritical liars whose consciences have been seared as with a hot iron. They forbid people to marry and order them to abstain from certain foods which God created to be received with thanksgiving by those who believe and who know the truth. This is not exactly the same expression, the last days. It's the latter days in the King James Version. It's a slightly different expression. But when's it talking about? Is it talking about sometime in the past? Is it talking about the present? Is it talking about sometime in the future? When's it talking about? And then let's turn to 2 Peter chapter 3, page 861. 2 Peter 3, page 861. 2 Peter 3, and we'll read verse 3. He says there, first of all, you must understand that in the last days, scoffers will come, scoffing and following their own evil desires. They will say, where is this coming he promised? Ever since our fathers died, everything goes on as it has been since the beginning of creation. Are we in the last days? Are we in times like we've read about in 1 Timothy and 2 Timothy and Peter? We may be in days like that. But that does not necessarily mean that Christ is coming soon. What Paul and Peter are saying is nothing different to what Jacob was saying in Genesis 49. I'm telling you what it's going to be like in the future, in days to come. I'm telling you what's going to happen in the future, in days to come. Sometime in the future, things are going to be like this. And it's not a pretty picture. It's pretty horrible. Because what you have described, particularly in 2 Timothy chapter 3, are the effects of sinful human nature. Nothing especially evil, nothing especially satanic, but basically things that do with sin and selfishness. As Christ said, out of the heart of man come forth murders, fornications, adultery, and so on and so on and so on. We don't need to look to Satan for some of those things, we just need to look inside ourselves. Are the days we are living in that bad? And that again depends on your perspective. 100 years ago in Britain, it was considered the last days, very seriously. And if you read Victorian, early Victorian theologians, they basically saw it was the last days and Christ was expected to come back very soon. Why did they think it was the last days, 110, 120 years ago? There was gross poverty and starvation. And there was plagues and illnesses. They had opium dens and gin houses. They had abortion. They had child prostitution. They had homosexuality. They had violence. They had murder. People like Jack the Ripper. Dickens wrote about it. Many social evils. But what happened? Well, there was a big Christian revival. There were the reform laws. And many of these things were done away with. The British Empire spread its wings. Its soldiers conquered the world, except America. And its missionaries saved the world, converted it. So much so that the talk of the last days totally disappeared from later Victorian theology. And in actual fact, amazingly, in later Victorian theology, you get the rise of what's called post-millennialism. Now, post-millennialism was always a Catholic doctrine. Catholic doctrine believes that the Catholic Church is to bring in the kingdom, to bring in the millennium, and after the Church has ruled for 1,000 years, Christ returns and accepts the millennial kingdom of 1,000 years' peace from the Church. That's the Catholic, if you like, standard Catholic prophetic scenario. I'm not saying all Catholics believe it. Please don't think I'm saying that. But that was the standard Catholic theology that's been around for some time. It started to get, in Victorian England, it started to be embraced by the Protestant churches. Because they were saying, look at us, we've done away with all this opium and gin houses, we've closed down the prostitution, we've got crime under control, people are being well fed, we're converting the world. Look at what we're doing. Things are improving absolutely incredibly. Fantastic lifestyle. Queen Victoria sat on her throne, reigned and smiled. Life was great. The Church was going to bring in the millennium. And then you had the First World War. Then you had the Depression. Then you had the Second World War. And post-millennium totally disappeared from the Protestant churches. Totally disappeared. See, all too often you can build your theology into your social conditions. You use your social conditions primary, not the Bible primary, for your theology. So you have your social conditions, then you go looking for verses in the Bible to justify it. And that's what you do. That's what we all have a tendency to do. I'm no different from anybody else. I need to be corrected. I need to continually go back to the Bible and say, what does this actually mean? And so, you know, from the end of last century to the beginning of this century, where you had the perfect peace and tranquility in Britain, you had devastation. And then in the 50s, you had the peace and tranquility, the quietude and the contentment. People were happy. Many people had gone through two world wars. The older people had gone through two world wars and the Depression. They were happy just to sit at home and be content. And you know what came after the 50s, don't you? The good old 60s and 70s. The chaotic 60s and 70s with mind-blowing immorality, psychedelic drugs. And we're back into the talk of the last days again. So today, are things as bad as all that? It depends. If you compare it to the 1950s, yes, there are lots of things in our society to be very concerned about, to be very worried. This is not the millennium. It's not perfect. Things could be an awful lot better. But if I compare today with Victorian England of the 1880s, things are a lot better. If you compare it to the Wild West, with its whorehouses, its saloons, its gambling dens, its gun law, we live in a society that's much, much better. So when you read these passages that talk about the last days, don't automatically think that it's talking about the times leading up to Christ's return. It isn't. It's actually talking about some time in the future. And as one theologian talks about in 2 Timothy chapter 3, he says, how can this be a prophecy? Because human beings have always been like this. This is a description of sinful human beings and its manifestation. He comes to the conclusion, wrongly I believe, but he comes to the conclusion that 2 Timothy 3 is not a description of the world, but a description of the Christian church. He says that immorality in the church is going to get so great that the church becomes like this. Well, that's the only way he can make sense of it, is seeing it as a significant prophecy relating to the days leading up to Christ's return. As I say, I don't agree with him, but I think he can see the problem, that it's not a specific prophecy. It is a prophecy telling Timothy, look, I tell you, Timothy, what's going to happen in the days to come. And some of these things happened in Timothy's day. And basically, as human beings exist in cycles, where we go in waves, we have good times, we have bad times, we have revivals, we have falling aways, we have times when morality is high and holy, and other times when it's low and depraved. This is a prophecy that says, look, this is what life's going to be like. This is what life is going to be like. And so, what really are the signs leading up to the second coming of Christ? Are there any in the Bible? Yes, there are. But we'll have to look at those next week. At the beginning of the year, when I gave out my usual annual questionnaire and asked people what subject they wanted me to talk on, one of the questions was signs of the second coming. And last week I dealt with the expression the last days. And if you weren't here and you want that talk, you can get it on cassette. Just fill in the form on the back page of the bulletin. Because basically, the expression the last days, as I pointed out last time, just really means days to come. It's not a specific expression referring to days leading up to Christ's return. That's the expression we have given it. That's the meaning we have given it. But if you look at the biblical context of the expression the last days, you will see that it refers, in those prophecies which have already come true, which talk about the last days, refer to a wide variety of future times. So we have to be a bit careful when we handle that expression, the last days. We also have to be very careful when we actually start talking about events leading up to Christ's second coming, because there are very few passages, actually, which clearly and unambiguously describe the events leading up to Christ's second coming. There certainly is the book of Revelation, but if you think that's clear and unambiguous, well, fair enough. I would just have to disagree with you, because certainly I don't find Revelation clear or unambiguous. There are certain passages of it, some of which I will look at today, which are pretty clear. But there is much of it which is very figurative, very allegorical, and which demands an intense knowledge of the Old Testament before you can actually understand it. So, one of the passages which really does talk a lot about Christ's second coming is Matthew 24, the passage we read. And if you'd like to turn to Matthew 24, please, on page 701, then we will have a look at it. Now, if you wish to take this subject, or if you find what I say interesting today and want to look at it a little bit further, I have written two booklets on the two passages I wish to look at. Matthew 24, the booklet is called Signs of the Second Coming, and Revelation 13, which talks about the mark of the beast in the Jerusalem temple. They're out on the table there, and I think they're both $2.50. So if you want them, please just take them and leave the money in the basket there. But if you look at Matthew chapter 24, the issue was that Jesus had come out of the temple having really had a tough time with the Pharisees, the scribes, and all the people there. And in Matthew chapter 24 verse 1, he says, Jesus left the temple and was walking away when his disciples came to him to call his attention to its building. It was a very beautiful building, very big building, massive building in actual fact, a building to be very proud of. And who knows exactly what the disciples were saying to Christ, glorying in the building, glorifying in the building of the temple, and that the temple really had taken the place of God. And so Christ turned to them and said, do you see all these things? I tell you the truth, not one stone here will be left on another. Everyone will be thrown down. Wow. I think that must have silenced the disciples for a while. I don't know exactly where they were when those words were said to them, but if you come out of the temple, you have to descend into the Kidron Valley, go basically through where the Garden of Gethsemane was, up through the olive grove onto the Mount of Olives. And from the Mount of Olives you can look down and you can see Jerusalem and its temple, which would have been spread out before them. And so verse 3 says, as Jesus was sitting on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately. They were probably looking at the temple. And they said, tell us, they said, when will this happen? When will the temple be destroyed? And what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? Those are the three questions that they asked the Lord. Now, it's quite understandable for them to want to ask questions like that. I mean, they didn't have any psychic network they could call, did they? I mean, who do they call? They're interested in prophecy. They're interested in the future. We all are. We all are interested in the future. We'd all like to know something more about it. We'd all like to know what would happen if we did this or if we didn't do that. Part of human beings, part of our failure, part of our sin. I don't know. I don't think it's part of our sin to want to know what the future is. It's because of our sinfulness, because we don't know the future, because we don't know how things are going to plan out, that we really want to know a bit about the future. So I don't think necessarily the desire to know something about the future is always out of malicious or bad or wrong motives. It's out of our weaknesses that we actually want to know something about the future. And they wanted to know, when would this be? Well, you've got three questions and you've got a very long answer. And it is very difficult sometimes to know in Matthew 24 which of those questions is the Lord answering. When is he talking about the destruction of the temple? When is he talking about the signs of his coming? And when is he talking about the end of the age? Are they all mushed together? Or are they separate? If you read different theologians, different answers come up because different people attribute different parts of Matthew 24 to answering different parts of that question. Now, don't dismiss people you disagree with on prophecy, because they're as equally likely to be wrong as you are, or equally likely to be right as you are. I don't know. I remember years ago, well, I know some of you know that we're going down to Oklahoma, and we're looking forward to going down there and seeing some friends down there. And the founding pastor of that church, a gentleman by the name of Clifford McLean, died 6 years ago, just before I came to America. And Clifford wrote a book on prophecy called Elijah's Coming and Other Neglected Prophecies. I don't know if I agree with all that he wrote in that book, but I certainly agreed with his preface. And his preface was that, look, when you deal with prophecy, basically you have to have a degree of humility. And he said, look at the four prophecies that come in Matthew chapter 1 and 2 relating to the birth of our Lord Jesus Christ. That he was to be born of a maiden, stroke virgin, that he was to be called out of Egypt, that he was to be called a Nazarene, and that there would be crying and wailing in Bethlehem. He said, if you lived 100 years before Christ's birth, how would you have interpreted those prophecies? Would you have even seen them as prophecies? And what order would you have put them in? And when I read that opening section of Clifford's book, I had to admit that if I had lived 100 years before Christ, I don't think I would have seen some of those as prophecies at all. Certainly I would never have understood them or interpreted in the way in which they were fulfilled. And really, when it comes to prophecy, we all have to have a very, very strong degree of modesty. And we all have to admit that probably what we say is wrong. So what I'm going to tell you today is probably wrong. Right? I will try and interpret Matthew 24 for you. Alright? I will try. Because obviously some people get very worried and very concerned because of what they read or what they hear on the radio or on television. It's the end times, it's all going to build up, we can have this, that and the other, and a disaster doom. Really?
Really.
Matthew 24 says this, Jesus answered, watch out that no one deceives you, for many will come in my name claiming I am the Christ, and will deceive many. You will hear of wars and rumors of wars, but see to it that you are not alarmed. Such things must happen, but the end is still to come. So none of those things really, strictly speaking, are signs of the end times. The end is still to come. The end times are still to come. And if you look at the history of the world, there's always been wars and rumors of wars, nation against nation, kingdom against kingdom, famine, earthquakes. It goes on and on, doesn't it? Okay? Now, we are living in quite a peaceful time from our perspective, but hey, look at all the wars. And we may look at some of these wars that are going on today as minor skirmishes, because we are interpret them in the light of the First World War and the Second World War. But many of these minor skirmishes that we call today minor wars would have been massive in biblical days. They would have been massive. So we have to be very careful when we interpret this passage, how we understand it, how we interpret it. And basically, if we are going to give it any meaning, we have to interpret it locally, geographically, in the region of Judea and Jerusalem. When you hear, you in Jerusalem, you are sitting here by the side of me looking at the temple. Look, when you hear, you know, wars and rumors of wars, when the nations around you are fighting, when the kingdoms around you are fighting, when there's famines around you, when there's earthquakes around you, okay. Now when you interpret it like that, you do give it more significance. And most miracles, most prophecies have to have a significance. They have to have a sign. They can't be too general, otherwise they lose their significance, they lose their sign. So if you want to interpret this as futuristic, as end time, you have to zoom in to locally. And that's a theme that will come out of Matthew 25:24 as we look through it. Verse 9, then you will be handed over to be persecuted and put to death, and you will be hated by all nations because of me. At that time many will turn away from the faith and betray many and hate each other, and many false prophets will appear and deceive many people. Because of the increase of wickedness, the love of most will grow cold, but he who stands firm to the end will be saved. And this gospel of the kingdom will be preached in the whole world as a testimony to all nations, and then the end, or the end times, will come. So all this has to happen before. Now when you look at this section, verses 9 through 14, you will actually find that a lot of this, if not all of this, was actually happened. It happened during the book of the Acts. It happened at that point in time. Now I'm not an historicist. An historicist is somebody who says that all prophecy has been fulfilled in the past. Right? I don't believe all prophecy has been fulfilled in the past. I don't believe Christ has come the second time. They see the second coming of Christ in the coming of the Holy Spirit. I'm not of that persuasion. But I have to be honest and say, when I look at that section and I look and see what happened during the book of Acts, then I have to say, Paul wrote, all in Asia have turned against me. There's none. Beware of the circumcision. He's talking of Christian Jews. Beware of them. There were famines during the book of the Acts, terrible famines. You know? So, some people see this section as answering the question, when is the temple going to be destroyed? When is the temple going to be destroyed? He's basically saying, look, this is all going to happen before the destruction of the temple. Now, whether they're right in that, I don't know. I am just sharing these views with you. Again, if you wish to put this in future end times, then you have to localize it. Who's he talking about when he says you're going to be handed over and persecuted to death? He's talking to the Jews. This is who he's talking to. You're going to be hated by all nations because of me. The nation of Israel, is going to be hated by all other nations because of me. That nation, you're going to become totally isolated in the world. Now, you can perhaps see that happening. And so there may well be a futuristic application or even a futuristic interpretation of this passage. And when that happens, many are going to turn away from the faith, give in their faith. Which faith is this? Is this Christian Jews, or is this Jews who believe in Jehovah, fundamentalist Jews? Right? Because in Israel, it's the fundamentalist Jews which are actually causing a lot of the problems. Those who want to go back to the law of Moses, not those who wish to worship Christ. So you've got to be very, very careful here. You've got to be very careful how you actually interpret this. If you wish to interpret this worldwide to Christians, you've got a problem. Christians have been persecuted throughout the ages. Go back to the good old reigns in Britain of people like King Henry VIII and his daughter Queen Mary, and all the burning of the stakes of Christian persecution, tortured on the racks. Go through the Reformation. Wow, boy, it was there. Go back to 350 AD when Constantine made Catholicism, if you like to call it, he called it Christianity, the official religion of the Roman Empire. And look how many people were burnt, massacred at that time because they would not conform to the official Christian line of that time. And it's gone on and on and on and on like that. What sign is it? What significance is it? It bears no significance at all. But then when you get to verse 15, onwards, it becomes abundantly obvious then that, look, all of this passage must be interpreted with respect to Jerusalem, Judea, and the people of Israel. Look at what he says in verse 15. So, when you see standing in the holy place, now what's the holy place? Well, the holy place was part of the temple. As I said, the temple was a massive building. Around the outside, if you like, was the court of the Gentiles, where anyone could come. Then you went through a dividing wall, which said that anybody who wasn't circumcised would be stoned to death. You went into the inner courts. And then, right in the center, was the area reserved for the priests. And then, in the center of that, was a building which was in two halves, the holy place and the most holy place. The most holy place was the high priest went into once a year. The holy place at the front was where different priests, by lot, they cast lots to see which priest would go in there to do the various duties. The lighting of the incense, placing of the showbread, and various things like that. There, that's the holy place. So Christ says, so when you see standing in the holy place, in the temple, the abomination that causes desolation spoken through the prophet Daniel, let the reader understand, then let those who are in Judea flee into the mountains. You see, this abomination, whatever it is, we'll come to that in a moment, is set up in the holy place in the temple in Jerusalem, in the inner court. No Gentile is going to see it. No Christian would be allowed in there. Only a circumcised worshipper, a circumcised Jew, a circumcised male would be allowed in there. And it's there, in the front part of this special place, which only priests can go into, and they choose which priests are going to do it by lot. That's what's going to happen. When you see this happen, says the Lord, now, let those in Judea flee into the mountains. Those in Judea. Not those in England, not those in America, those in Judea. This shows us that this prophecy is relating to Jerusalem, the temple, Judea, Israel, and the people of the Jews. In fact, I would say this, that practically, and I might almost say exclusively, but I won't, but practically all prophecy relates to the people of Israel. Jerusalem, Judea, and the countries around. It doesn't very little of it relates to Christians. If any relates to Christians, there's some in Revelation which relates to Christian Jews, and there's some in other places that relate to Christian Jews. But very little relates to Christian Gentiles. So, when you see the abomination standing in the holy place, flee into Judea. Now, this was not fulfilled in AD 70 with the destruction of the temple. The Romans came in and they did destroy the temple. They took it apart, literally brick by brick, and took it away. But they did not set up an abomination. They did not go into the holy place and set up an abomination. And that's why I can't take the historicist line. Is that yes, I can see a good case, and I can see a case for verses 4 to 14, if you like, having perhaps fulfillment or major fulfillment in the days following Christ's ascension until the destruction of the temple in AD 70. But when you get here, I can't see a case for it. I cannot see a case for that. Look at verse 17. It says, let no one on the roof of his house go down to take anything out of the house. Let no one in the field go back to get his cloak. How dreadful it will be for those in those days for pregnant women and nursing mothers. Pray that your flight will not take place in the winter or on the Sabbath. Why not on the Sabbath? Well, again, the Jews were only allowed to travel a certain distance on the Sabbath. So, hey, if you've got to flee, if this event takes place on the Sabbath day, or the eve of the Sabbath, you're not going to be able to escape. So pray that it doesn't take place on the Sabbath. You're not going to be able to escape from Jerusalem. You're not going to be able to flee into the mountains, because you can only go a mile, or whatever the distance was. Verse 21. For then there will be great distress, unequal from the beginning of the world until now, and never to be equaled again. If those days had not been cut short, no one would survive. But for the sake of the elect, those days will be shortened. And you get this expression, the elect, occurring a number of times. It's in verse 22, it's in verse 24, it's in verse 31. And at this time, who were God's elect? Israel were the elect nation. Now you can say today, yes, Christians are God's elect. We've been chosen in Christ before the foundation of the world to be holy and blameless in God's eyes. We've been chosen, we've been elected. That's true. At this point in time, Christians are God's elect. But at Matthew 24, when Christ spoke these words, who were God's elect? It was the nation of Israel. It was the nation of Israel. So, you know, these times are going to be so bad, these times are going to be so bad that it would be possible for this nation to be wiped out, says Christ. At that time, if anyone says to you, look here, is the Christ, or there he is, do not believe it, for false Christs and false prophets will appear and will perform great signs and miracles to deceive even the elect. So, during this period of time, when this abomination of desolation spoken of by the prophet Daniel is set up in the holy place, you could have false Christs, false messiahs, false saviors, who are going to come to Israel and say, look, we're the ones, you know. We're the ones. See, the trouble with us and the word Christ is that the word Christ to us always refers to the Lord Jesus Christ. Right? But the word Christ in Greek is the same as the word Messiah in Hebrew. A Messiah, a Savior. And so you're going to get false ones. You're going to get false people coming to Israel. Then he says in verse 26, so if anyone tells you, there he is out in the desert, do not go out. Or here he is in the inner rooms, do not believe it. For as the lightning that comes from the east is visible even in the west, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. Wherever there is a carcass, there the vultures will gather. Very sinister. Such as will be the destruction at that time in Israel. Immediately after the distress of those days, the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light. The stars will fall from the sky and the heavenly bodies will be shaken. At that time, the sign of the Son of Man will appear in the sky and all the nations of the earth will mourn. They will see the Son of Man coming in the clouds of the sky with power and great glory, and he will send his angels with a loud trumpet, and they will gather his elect from the four winds, from the one end of heaven to the other. The gathering of the elect, the gathering of Israel. The gathering of Israel. It's there. It's there. So, we have to ask ourselves, here we have a prophecy which is unfulfilled. When exactly does it take place? This abomination of desolation spoken of by the prophet Daniel. When does it take place? How long before Christ returns does it take place? Well, before we answer that question, let's go on to 2 Thessalonians on page 838. 2 Thessalonians. There are many today who are concerned about the coming of Christ, that it be near, that it be soon, that we're living in the end times. This is no new thing. It's been going on since Thessalonians was written. Let's look at 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 verse 1. Concerning the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ and our being gathered to him, we ask you, brothers, not to be easily unsettled or alarmed by some prophecy, report, or letter supposed to have come from us, saying that the day of the Lord has already come. You see, somebody had been to Thessalonica or written to the Thessalonians and saying, look, we're in the end times, this is it, it's all going to happen. Wham! Hang on, says Paul, hang on. Verse 3, don't let anyone deceive you in any way, for that day will not come until the rebellion occurs and the man of lawlessness is revealed, the man doomed to destruction. He will oppose and will exalt himself over everything that is called God or is worshipped, so that he sets himself up in God's temple, proclaiming himself to be God. The abomination that causes desolation, set up in the holy place, as said by the prophet Daniel. Here you're going to have some person who is going to set himself up in the temple. Not in the Vatican. Not in the Canterbury Cathedral, the head of the Episcopal Church. In the temple. This again is not primarily attack on Christianity, this is primarily attack on Judaism. This is what he's dealing with, the temple. Somebody is going to set himself up in the temple proclaiming himself to be God. That's what's going to happen. That is what exactly is going to happen. Now, when did this happen? It didn't happen in AD 70. Sure, I think it was under Titus, the Romans came in, took it all apart. But they didn't go in there and set up Titus or set up an image of him or whoever the Caesar was at the time and say bow down and worship. They just destroyed it. Let's turn to Revelation 13. Revelation chapter 13. In Revelation chapter 13 on page 874 we have what is probably one of the most well-known, famous, sinister prophecies in the Bible. 666. Great subject of many writings, many films. Chapter 13 verse 1 says, "And the dragon stood on the shore of the sea, and I saw a beast coming out of the sea." Now, when the Jews talk about the sea, they talk about the Mediterranean Sea. Unless they talk about the Dead Sea, which is obviously the Dead Sea, or the Sea of Galilee, or whatever it's one of its names called. An unspecified sea is usually the Mediterranean Sea. And so, here again, you've got this local context. Verse 11 says, "Then I saw another beast coming out of the earth. He had two horns like a lamb, but he spoke like a dragon. He exercised all the authority of the first beast on his behalf, and made the earth and its inhabitants worship the first beast, whose fatal wound had been healed. And he performed great and miraculous signs, even causing fire to come down from heaven to earth in full view of man." Fire from heaven. This is what he's going to do. He's going to do miracles, including fire from heaven. Now, remember, when Abraham was called by God, he called for fire to come down from heaven to consume his sacrifice, and it did. If you remember when Elijah fought the prophets of Baal, he called for fire to come down from heaven to consume his sacrifice, but not Baal. And it did. And you can see a number of times in the scriptures that God always verified his prophet, his apostle, his minister, his servant with fire from heaven. Now, that's how all the Jewish people, that's how they were verified by God. Here you have some being at the end time that is going to be able to bring down fire from heaven in Jerusalem, in Judea. Now what's going to happen? What's going to happen? What will the Jews think? If you put it in this historical context, the Jews will think, wow, this person's from God. This person's from Jehovah. Wow. We must do what this person says. We must follow what this person teaches. Verse 14, "Because of the signs he was given power to do on behalf of the beast, he deceived the inhabitants of the earth. He ordered them to set up an image in honor of the beast who was wounded by the sword and yet lived. He was given power to give breath to the image of the first beast, so it could speak and cause all who refused to worship the image to be killed. He also forced everyone, small and great, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive a mark on his right hand or in his forehead, so that no one could buy or sell unless he had the mark, which is the name of the beast or the number of his name. This calls for wisdom. If anyone has insight, let him calculate the number of the beast, for it is man's number. His number is 666. And so, you get this image, this beast set up in the temple, in the holy place. And those people, those Jews, have to go in and worship it. Now, let's turn to Deuteronomy chapter 11. Deuteronomy chapter 11. I didn't put this one down, it's on page 134. Deuteronomy 11. Again, this shows how this mark of the beast on the forehead or in the hand is again very Jewish. Very Jewish indeed. In Deuteronomy chapter 11, verse 16, this is what it says. "Be careful, or you will be enticed to turn away and worship other gods and bow down to them. Then the Lord's anger will burn against you, and he will shut the heavens so they will not rain, and the ground will not yield nor produce, and you will soon perish from the good land the Lord is giving you. Fix these words of mine in your hearts and minds. Tie them as symbols on your hands and bind them to your forehead. And so you have what's called phylacteries. These are little things, you might have seen them on some Jews, they bind them around their head, there's a little box there. Or they wrap them around their arm, and they're on their hand there. And they basically contain 10 words, or 10 symbols, summarizing the 10 commandments and the law. And that's what many Orthodox Jews still wear. You go to Israel, you will see them. You go to the airport when they're told to take off their jackets because they've gone through a little thing which goes beep, 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 and they can't find out where it is. They take off their jackets and you can see it all wrapped around their arms. There. No, you take off the phylacteries and you put on the mark of the beast. You stop worshipping God and you bow down and you worship the image of the beast. Now, when does this occur? When is it to happen? How long before Christ returns? Now, you will notice that a number of passages that I have read, it talks about the inhabitants of the earth. It talks about the tribes of the earth, the nations of the earth. Now, because of expressions like that, this is why many people think this prophecy is worldwide. And that is understandable, by translation. But unfortunately, the word for earth is the same as the word for land. And so when it talks about the inhabitants of the earth, the Greek could read the inhabitants of the land of Palestine. And when he talks about the nations, it could be talking about the tribes. The tribes of the land will bow down and worship. Now, which is the correct translation? You see, translating from one language to another is not a precise science. If you don't take the context into account, nations of the earth or tribes of the land are equally good translations. They're perfectly equally good translations. So you have to say from the context, okay, let's look at this in the context now, for me to say, is this worldwide and does it refer to nations of the world, or is it local and does it refer to tribes of the land? My view is that when you look at that context, and you look at the context of what it's talking about the holy place. It's talking about those in Judea fleeing into the mountains. It's talking about, beware, you know, it's not on a Sabbath day. It's talking about the temple. It's talking about hands and the heads and phylacteries. When he's talking about things like that, then I say, well look, it's not talking predominantly about Christians, it's talking about Jews. And basically this is an attack on the first commandment for the people of Israel, who are told, you shall worship no other god before me, you shall not bow down to any god before me. And here, at this end time, you have, if you like, this great attack of Satan upon the people of Israel, in which he says, you are going to worship me. You are going to worship me. And you're going to worship me right in the center of your temple. That's where you're going to worship me. And if you don't, you will be killed. The choice is yours. That's what's going to happen. Well, God has provided Israel with another choice. There's a passage in Romans which we often take comfort from, which talks about God should not test anyone above what they can stand, except he will find a way of escape. And he has provided a way of escape for Israel. We read about it in Matthew 24, and it says, flee into the mountain. When you see this happen, flee into the mountain. Don't stop and take any food with you. Don't stop and take a coat with you. Just get out. And it tells us in other parts of the Bible that while they're in the wilderness there, God is going to feed them for 3.5 years. Now, that's no problem for God to feed Israel for 3.5 years in the wilderness. In the Old Testament, he fed them for 40 years in the wilderness. And you will find this period of time, this 3.5 years, is a very significant period of time. Let's turn to Daniel chapter 9, please. Daniel chapter 9. It's on page 633. Daniel chapter 9. Here in Daniel chapter 9 verse 24 we read of 77s are to grieve for your people. Notice your people, that's Daniel's people, your holy city, that's Jerusalem, to finish transgression, to put an end to sin, to atone for wickedness, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal up vision and prophecy, and to anoint the most holy. Wow, what does all that mean? Well, that's not our subject today. But it's 77s on your people in your holy city. Again, it's to do with the people of Israel, and it's to do with Jerusalem. That's what it's to do with. And he ends up in verse 27 and saying, look, he talks about this person that we've been reading about in Revelation, this person that we've been reading about in Thessalonians. He will confirm a covenant with the many, with the people of Israel, for 1:7. And in the middle of the seven, he will put an end to sacrifice and offering, and on a wing of the temple he will set up an abomination that causes desolation until the end of his decreed is poured out on him. So basically, this Antichrist, this Satan man, this false prophet, whether they're all the same people or different people, let's see what the future brings. That'll sort it out for us. But hey, he's going to make this 7-year covenant with the people of Israel. And this 7-year covenant with the people of Israel is going to allow them to have their morning and evening sacrifice. This tells me that when this person comes on the scene, the temple hasn't even been rebuilt. Because if the temple had been rebuilt, Israel would already be having its morning and evening sacrifices. So basically, this person, this very nice person, very friendly person, gives the people of Israel what they want. What the people of Israel want? They want their temple. That's what they want. They want their temple. They want to worship God in their way, in the ways according to the law of the Old Testament. They want their evening and morning sacrifices. And he says, you can do it. You can do it. I'll let you do it. Some people have said, because of this, this person must be a Muslim, must be a very powerful Islamic ruler, because who else could give permission like that in the present state of affairs out there? Whether that interpretation is correct or not, well, let's wait for the future, shall we? Let's see what happens out there when these times actually arrive. But, hey, I can't see how there could be a temple there, because otherwise Israel would be having their evening and morning sacrifices. So this 7-year agreement basically says to Israel, okay, build your temple, start your sacrifices. And then for one reason or another, he breaks the agreement. At the 3.5-year point, he is the one that goes into the temple and says, you worship me. He obviously gets a bit bored, he doesn't want to be in there all the time, so he sets up an image of himself in there and says to his soldiers, to his priests, to his prophets, you make certain everyone bows down to that image. All these Jews have to come in here and bow down to this image, and they have to take my mark in their hands or their foreheads, and if they don't, they will be beheaded. That's the situation. Now, as I say, when you deal with prophecy, you have to recognize that it's a very difficult subject. As I said, I would never have interpreted those four prophecies mentioned in Matthew chapter 1 and 2 correctly if I had lived 100 years before their fulfillment. And I'm not saying, please, that what I say here today is going to be 100% exact. But what I do see very clearly, is that it is dealing with Jerusalem. It is dealing with the temple. It is dealing with the holy place. It is dealing with the Jews. This is what it's dealing with. These are the people involved. That is clear, and that's unambiguous. Now, the exact details of what might happen, well, I could be well off on. But when you see this abomination of desolation spoken of by the prophet Daniel, set up in the holy place, flee into the wilderness, and you've got 3.5 years to go. You have 3.5 years to go. That is the most significant point in time from prophecy, if you like, to know when you're in the, as we mean, the end times, the last days leading up to Christ's return. Now we can go back earlier and say, well, look, if we're aware, we should notice when that 7-year agreement is made. Yeah, we should. We should. If we are still alive, if we are politically aware, if it becomes a big international issue. But it may not. I really don't know. But my words to finish with is back in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, please. 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. Because really, this says it all for me. So many people get so uptight about so many of the things that are happening in today's world. We live in such terrible times, and as I said last week, if you know your history, we don't live in terrible times. There's been far, far worse periods of time in history than the ones that we live. I'm talking about from the moral and the corrupt point of view. And I would just say to you this, 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 verse 1, concerning the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ and our being gathered to him, we ask you, brothers, not to become easily unsettled or alarmed by some of the things you might see on Christian television, or read in Christian books, or read in Christian newspapers. I wouldn't become unsettled by them. We live in a country which has its problems. It's had worse problems in the past than we have at the present. It's had far more corruption in the past than we have at the present. We live in a world which certainly has its problems. But in the past it's had far more problems than we have at the present. It's been far more corrupt than it is at the present. It's been far more immoral than it has at the present. My own personal view is that we're still on a moral decline. You may disagree with me. I still think we have some way to go. We're still going down. What will happen? Will we bottom out and improve again, as has happened many times in history? Or will the decay and the decadence keep going down and down and down? I don't know. I'm not a psychic. I don't have the gift of prophecy. But I do have the scriptures. And the scriptures tell me to redeem each day, to live each day according to the Lord, to rejoice. This is the day the Lord has made, and I will let tomorrow look after itself. That's what the Lord said to the disciples. And those words are good enough for me.